because the ship's weapons, its arsenal, all of its magazines and explosive materials were stored right next to the coal bunkers. This is really a stupid thing to do. Anybody should know that. Coal dust is very explosive, and to put it right next to your explosives is really stupid. British historian, so it may have been an accident. It's possible. It might have been an accident. Maybe the thing just blew up because highly volatile, all the explosives and coal dust and all that. But there's another possibility. A British historian, Hugh Thomas, in his book Cuba, The Pursuit of Freedom in 1971, says that William Chandler, a member of the U.S. House of Representatives, who had connections with Theodore Roosevelt, may have bombed the Maine or may have been involved in a plot that bombed the Maine. Chandler was involved in smuggling arms to the Cuban insurrectionists against the Spanish. And in a conversation with the U.S. ambassador to Cuba in the 1930s, that's William Bullitt, Chandler had claimed responsibility and confessed that he had been a party to blowing up the Maine. But we don't know anything more about it than that, because Chandler died very shortly thereafterwards. I don't know how we could speculate on how, whether he was killed or whether he just, it's a coincidence. Maybe it was a deathbed confession, you know, knew he was going to die, so he wanted to get it off his chest. Okay, the follow-up to the pretext, this is really classic follow-up. We don't know whether it was an accident or an inside job, but what we do know is that the media immediately blamed Spain, and they built public support for the war. Even the Maine's captain cautioned against assuming that it was an enemy attack. And when he did that, the press denounced him for, quote, refusing to see the obvious. The Atlantic Monthly said that anyone thinking this was not a premeditated Spanish act of war was, quote, completely at defiance of the odds of probability. William Randolph Hearst, when he heard about the sinking of the Maine, he said, this means war. In his New York Journal, he had something like 8 pages of, every day there for weeks, there was 8 pages of stuff about the horrible sinking of the Maine and the atrocity by the Spanish. And his headline read, "The warship Maine was split in two by an enemy's secret infernal machine." And the front page carried a drawing of the ship sitting on top of mines that had obviously been set by the Spanish, even though there was no evidence of that. The U.S. newspapers sent hundreds of reporters and photographers down to Cuba to cover the war. And photographer Frederick Remington wrote back to Hearst saying, quote, "There is no war. Request to be recalled." Hearst's cable replied, quote, "Please remain. You furnish the pictures. I'll furnish the war." For weeks, as I said, Hearst's journal dedicated pages and pages to the explosion. A Cuban writer, Guillermo Soler, summarized the intensive press campaigns, and he said that they, quote, "incited jingoism, pandering to the most shameless tales and sensationalism, and exacerbated cheap sentimentality. Joseph Pulitzer of The World and William Randolph Hearst of The Journal, the two largest U.S. papers, carried their rivalry to a paroxysm of inflaming public opinion with scandalous, provocative, and imaginary stories designed to win acceptance of U.S. participation in the first of its holy wars beyond its maritime borders." And the slogan that was used to rally the public was, "Remember the Maine, to hell with Spain." It was a rallying cry for retaliation. And the U.S. public was soon safely on board. And on April 25th, 1898, the U.S. Congress declared war on Spain, and the U.S. military launched an era of what's called gunboat diplomacy. Now, the real reasons for this war, again, are quite simple. The Spanish Empire was basically falling apart. They didn't have the power anymore to control their empire, and the Americans just wanted to take it over. And during the four-month war, Spanish-American War, and the U.S., at the end of those 4 months, the U.S. had replaced Spain as the colonial master in the Philippines, Guam, Puerto Rico, and Cuba. And the John Hay, a future U.S. Secretary of State, called it, quote, "a splendid little war." Okay, 1915, World War I. Context: Europe's imperial powers deeply embroiled in a war, the U.S. public strongly opposed to any involvement, President Wilson vowing that the United States would remain neutral, and Britain desperately wanting the United States to join the war and become an ally in their fight. So this is a pretext incident to get the United States into the war that was already going on, and it wasn't really immediately successful, but it did help. And it fits the modus operandi of the war pretext incident. On May 7th, 1915, a German submarine, a U-boat, sank the Lusitania. It was a British passenger ship, and about 1,200 people died, including 130 Americans. The public was not told at the time that the passengers were, in effect, being used as human shields to protect 6 million rounds of U.S. ammunition that were bound for Britain. To Germany, the ship was a threat. To Britain, it was bait for luring an attack. Why would Britain want to have an attack? A week before the attack, British Admiralty leader Winston Churchill wrote to the Board of Trade's president saying, quote, "It is most important to attract neutral shipping to our shores in the hopes especially of embroiling the United States with Germany," unquote. Churchill had previously asked Navy Commander Joseph Kenilworthy, who was in the political section of Navy Intelligence, to write a report on the political results, the quote, "the political results of an ocean liner being sunk with American passengers on board." They were doing research into what would the effect be if the Germans sank a ship with Americans on board. Sounds pretty suspicious, eh? In 1927, Kenworthy, the guy who was asked to write this report, said in his book, Freedom of the Seas, quote, "The Lusitania was deliberately sent at considerably reduced speed into an area where a U-boat was known to be waiting and with their escorts withdrawn." In Patrick Beasley's History of World War I, British Naval Intelligence, he notes, "No, quote, no effective steps were taken to protect the Lusitania. British complicity is furthered by their foreknowledge that there were German submarines in the area. Two ships had been sunk in recent days right in the path of where the Lusitania was going. The U-boat commanders knew of the Lusitania's route, and the Brits knew that. And although destroyers were available, none escorted the Lusitania or hunted for U-boats. Okay, the follow-up. U.S. newspapers aroused outrage against Germany for ruthlessly killing defenseless Americans. The incident was used to help draw the U.S. into World War I. Soon thereafter, the Congress increased the size of the army, and then it allocated $7 billion for national defense, which was the largest sum ever appropriated up until that point. The real reasons that were simply that the British military, political, and business interests wanted the United States to help in their war with Germany, and Beasley concluded that, quote, "I am reluctantly driven to the conclusion that there was a conspiracy deliberately to put the Lusitania at risk in the hope that even an abortive attack on her would bring the U.S. into the war. Such a conspiracy could not have been put into effect without Winston Churchill's express permission and approval," unquote. In Churchill's own memoirs about World War I, called The World Crisis, he said, quote, "There are many maneuvers in war, some only of which take place on the battlefield. The maneuver which brings an ally into the field is as serviceable as that which wins a great battle." Okay, next big war, World War II. A little bit on the context, the context within the United States, the beginning of the war. The most powerful corporate leaders in the United States did not want a war against fascism. They were fascists. America's top industrialists and bankers were themselves fascists. They hated President Roosevelt's New Deal. They had already been aiding Hitler and Mussolini before the war, and they did so through the war, during the war. In fact, in 1933, there was a Wall Street plot to overthrow the Roosevelt government. Many of Wall Street's top industrialists and bankers financed and organized this plot. One of the conspirators, Gerald McGuire, said, quote, "We need a fascist government in this country to save the nation from the communists who want to tear it down and wreck all that we have built," unquote. The plot was exposed by Marine Corps General Smedley Butler, and he named names. We now know who the plotters were, and he also named an organization, the American Liberty League, which is an organization of top Wall Street multimillionaires. He said they were behind the coup plot. Of course, it never happened, thanks to whistleblower Smedley Butler. That whole thing about the plot, the coup, is the subject of the, here's my next shameless commercial advertisement for our magazine. The latest issue of our magazine deals entirely with that plot and the plotters and the corporate connections, the corporations, the huge organizations that are now amongst the world's largest corporations our organization, or our corporations that were owned by those plotters 70 years ago. So Roosevelt faced incredible isolationist sentiments from these multimillionaires who shared Hitler's hatred of communism. The media portrayed, promoted fascism. William Randolph Hearst, you'll remember him, the newspaper magnate. He actually employed Hitler, Mussolini, and Goering as writers for his papers. Hearst met Hitler in 1934 and used Reader's Digest and his 33 newspapers to boost fascism and oppose U.S. entry into the war. So there was an incredible, powerful people who controlled the mass media who did not want to go to war. So if you're going to go to war, you've got to have the public on board, so you're going to need a really dramatic pretext incident. Earlier, I noticed in the when Ian was doing the official narrative, even the people who believe in the official narrative, they put surprise attack of Pearl Harbor, they put it in quotation marks, surprise, like they're acknowledging that it wasn't a surprise. Anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. December 7th, 1941, Japan bombed the U.S. Pacific Fleet in Pearl Harbor. 2,460 were killed. FDR and his closest advisors not only knew of the attack in advance, but they did nothing to prevent it. They actually had taken deliberate actions to provoke it. The best research on this is provided by Robert Stinnett, author of Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor, 1999. He explains, quote, Germany, Italy, and Japan signed a mutual assistance treaty on September 27, 1940. 10 days later, Lieutenant Commander Arthur McCullum, a U.S. naval officer in the Office of Navy Intelligence, saw an opportunity to counter the U.S. isolationist movement by provoking Japan into a state of war with the United States, triggering the mutual assistance provisions of the Tripartite Pact and bringing America into World War II. McCullum's secret memo of October 7, 1940 was obtained through the Freedom of Information Act. It called for 8 provocations aimed at Japan. Its centerpiece was keeping the might of the U.S. fleet based in Hawaii as a lure for a Japanese attack, unquote. The memo that's referred to here, McCullum's memo, concluded, quote, if by these means Japan could be led to commit an overt act of war, so much the better, unquote. Upon receiving McCullum's memo, FDR immediately began to set the plan in motion. Soon after implementing step 8, the final step, Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. After meeting with FDR on October 16, 1941, Secretary of War Henry Stimson wrote in his diary, quote, we face the delicate question of the diplomatic fencing to be done so as to be sure Japan is put into the wrong and makes the first bad move, overt move, unquote. Stinnett also notes that on November 15, 1941, the Japanese forces moved to the attacking points for the Philippines, Pearl Harbor, Wake, and Guam. General Marshall, the Army's Chief of Staff, called in Washington bureau chiefs of the New York Times, the Herald Tribune, Newsweek, and Time. He pledged them to secrecy, and he told them that we had broken the Japanese codes and expected war to start in the first week of December 1941. The general obviously had a decoded message from the Japanese Chief of Naval Operations, who on November 5th had said that war would start with England, the Netherlands, and America the first week of December. On November 25th, after a meeting with FDR, Stimson, the War Secretary again, he said, quote, the question is, how should we maneuver them, that's the Japanese, into the position of firing the first shot? So the U.S. had cracked the Japanese codes, diplomatic and military, and a secret Army Board, U.S. Top Secret Army Board report from 1944 shows that the U.S. had known, quote, the probable exact hour and date of the Pearl Harbor attack. So the follow-up. The day after Pearl Harbor was bombed, FDR signed a declaration of war on Japan with media support. Remember, Pearl Harbor became a U.S. rallying cry. Germany and Italy quickly declared war on the United States. 1950, the Korean War. According to a tribunal in June 2001 by the International Action Center, that people may know of that. It's headed up by the former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. It said this about Korea. There is, quote, extensive evidence of U.S. crimes against peace and crimes against humanity, unquote, after the U.S. occupied South Korea in September 1945. The U.S. was guilty of creating, quote, a police state using former collaborators with Japanese rule, provoking tension, opposing and disrupting any plans for peaceful reunification. The U.S. trained, directed, and supported South Korea in systematic murder, imprisonment, torture, harassment, and violations of human rights of hundreds of thousands, especially nationalists, leftists, peasants seeking land reform, union organizers, and those sympathetic to the North. Okay, the pretext incident. On June 25, 1950, the North Korean military supposedly moved 3 miles into South Korean territory. Dr. Channing Liem, the former South Korean ambassador to the UN in 1960-61, wrote that for the U.S., quote, the question who fired the first shot carried special significance. Assistant Secretary of State for UN Affairs revealed before the Senate Appropriations Committee in 1950 that the U.S. devised a plan prior to the war to gain approval from the UN to send troops to Korea under the UN flag in the event that South Korea was attacked. It was imperative, therefore, that the first shot, in quotes, be fired by the North, or at least that such an argument could be made. South Korean President Ri met John Foster Dulles, the former U.S. Secretary of State, just days before the pretext incident, and said, quote, if he was ready to attack the Communist North, the U.S. would lend help through the UN. He advised Ri to persuade the world that South Korea was attacked first and to plan his actions accordingly. In 1955, Albert Einstein told Liem, quote, the U.S. was manipulating the UN, which was being exploited by the great powers at the expense of small nations. Einstein said, great powers do not act on the basis of facts alone, but manufacture the facts to serve their purposes and force their will on smaller nations, unquote. In Hidden History of the Korean War, I.F. Stone exposed details of how a U.S. diplomat deceived the U.N. Secretary General into believing that there was an unprovoked attack by North Korea. North Korea, its version of events, it claimed that the attack began actually 2 days earlier when the South had launched a 6-hour artillery attack and pushed 1 or 2 kilometers north across the border. And the North said that it responded to, quote, halt the enemy's advance and to go over to a decisive counterattack. It's worth noting that during the lead-up to the Korean War, there was a long pattern of South Korean incursions. University of Hawaii professor Oliver Lee said that South Korea was sending its troops into the North on a regular basis. In 1949 alone, there were at least 400 border engagements. And a U.S. Army document states, quote, some of the bloodiest engagements were caused by the South Korean units securing and preparing defensive positions that were either astride or north of the 38th parallel, that's the border between the two Koreas. This provoked violent North Korean actions, unquote. Okay, the follow-up. Following the incident, the U.S. accused North Korea of having committed, quote, brutal, unprovoked aggression. It said this attack appeared to be the first move in Stalin's plan for world domination. Liem says Secretary of State Dean Acheson was, quote, quick to seize the opportunity to blame the war on North Korea regardless of the evidence. Anyone opposing the war was labeled a communist. On June 27, 1950, Truman ordered U.S. troops to support South Korea. Congress agreed. The UN Security Council approved the plan. The U.S. and UN engaged North Korea and then Communist China in a terrible 3-year war. 3 million civilians were killed in the war, and 2/3 of them were in North Korea. The real reasons, a month before the pretext, South Korean President Ri had suffered a terrible electoral defeat. To maintain his faltering grip on power, he required more U.S. backing. By going to war with North Korea, he garnered much-needed U.S. military and diplomatic assistance. He diverted public attention away from his own repressive regime and the growing scandals that were growing around the repression that he was leading in South Korea. The war also tripled the Pentagon budget. It boosted NATO's military buildup. It created a whole new military role for the United Nations that could be manipulated by the United States. Okay, now we're going to move on to 1964, the Vietnam War. Context. Long before World War II, the Vietnamese had been fighting for independence from France. Resistance continued when the Japanese troops occupied the colony during the war. Much of the region reverted to French control after the war, the Second World War. As early as 1950, the U.S. aided French efforts to defeat Ho Chi Minh's revolutionary forces. When France lost a decisive battle in 1954, the Geneva Accord recognized the independence of Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. Vietnam was temporarily divided. Diem's repressive regime in South Vietnam was backed by thousands of U.S. military advisors. A military coup assassinated Diem, the South Vietnamese leader, in November 1963. Think of any other leaders assassinated in November 1963. That was the same month President Kennedy was assassinated. He had been resisting, to some extent, the escalation of the war there. But with his disappearance from the scene, the U.S. very quickly intensified its involvement in Vietnam under President Johnson. Pretext incident. The official story was that on July 30th, a U.S. destroyer, the USS Maddox, began what they called a routine patrol in North Vietnam's Gulf of Tonkin. On August 2nd and again on August 4th, the North Vietnamese patrol boats supposedly launched unprovoked attacks against the Maddox. This so-called Gulf of Tonkin incident was the trigger that escalated the Vietnam War. In reality, the Maddox was involved in what Jeff Cohen and Norman Solomon, co-authors of Adventures in Media Land, called, quote, aggressive intelligence gathering maneuvers in sync with coordinated attacks on North Vietnam by the South Vietnamese Navy and Laotian Air Force, unquote. Americans basically wanted to provoke a response. They sent their battleships in there. The North Vietnamese did not respond, so the military just faked it. They just pretended. They made it all up. The U.S. Task Force commander for the Gulf of Tonkin actually cabled back to Washington and with a report that the supposed attack was actually just an overeager sonar man who had picked up the sounds of his own ship's screws, and he panicked. But very quickly, the official narrative grew around these supposed attacks, fabricated attacks. And on August 5th, 1964, although he knew the attack was completely fabricated, Johnson used the opportunity for launching a full-scale war. He went on national TV to lie about the incident, and he announced a U.S. bombing campaign to retaliate. The media repeated the lie ad nauseum. For example, the Los Angeles Times urged Americans to, quote, face the fact that the communists, by their attack on American vessels in international waters, have themselves escalated the hostilities, unquote. The fabricated assaults were used to prod Congress into giving President Johnson the authority that he needed to launch a protracted war against Vietnam, North Vietnam. There was virtually no critical or skeptical analysis in the media. The Tonkin Bay Resolution, which amounted to a declaration of war against North Vietnam, flew through Congress on August 7th. Johnson asked Congress for powers to, quote, take all necessary measures to repel any armed attack against the forces of the U.S. and to prevent further aggression. Only two senators voted against it. Johnson signed the congressional resolution on August 10, 1964. By 1975, 4 million people, mostly civilians, had been killed in Southeast Asia. The real reasons, just as during the Spanish-American War, the Vietnam War was really a grab for the colonies of a failing colonial power. In this case, it wasn't Spain, it was France. And U.S. corporations wanted to gain access to the region's markets and resources. Things like tin, tungsten, and rubber were glowing in their eyes. They wanted those things. The war also gave a huge boost to the U.S. military-industrial complex. President Eisenhower, who was promoting the so-called domino theory as early as 1954, it was the sort of thought that they had, and there's a certain reality in the sense that you want to stop other countries from getting the idea that they can have an independence from the United States, or from colonial powers don't want anyone to get the idea that they can go on their own way as a separate independent nation. So the Vietnam War was a huge threat to all revolutionaries and their supporters. The message was, if you go communist, you'll have hell to pay. Don't even think about it. Okay, now we're going to skip forward to 1979, the covert war in Afghanistan. In 1973, the Afghan monarchy was overthrown by leftist organizations and parties like the People's Democratic Party, the PDP. The U.S. and Iran pressured the new leader, Mohammed Daoud, to sever ties with the Soviets. The U.S. offered $2 billion in aid, and Daoud's regime was soon co-opted. They turned against the people who had helped them take power. In April 1978, the PDP revolted and took power from Daud. The goal of their April revolution was to drag Afghanistan out of feudalism. Life expectancy was 40, infant mortality was 25%, there was widespread malnutrition, illiteracy was 90%. Here's a taste of their revolutionary programs and ideas. They were committed to Islam, but within a secular state. They canceled all peasants' debts to landlords. They built hundreds of schools and medical clinics. They outlawed child marriage, and they outlawed the exchange of women for money and commodities. They legalized trade unions, and they promoted women's education and literacy. They supported Cuba. They talked about class struggle. They talked about imperialism. This is a pretty radical government. The U.S., of course, was allied with the landowners, the warlords, and the business community. Almost immediately, the radical government was under attack by ultra-conservative Islamist counter-revolutionaries, the Mujahideen. These were the Contras of Afghanistan. They're like the Contras of Nicaragua. They were counter-revolutionaries supported by the United States, by the CIA. The Pretext Incident. 1997, Robert Gates, the CIA director between 91 and 93, said that the U.S. had provoked the December 79 Soviet intervention in Afghanistan by giving aid to the Mujahideen. He recalled a meeting 9 months before the Soviet intervention when the UN Secretary of Defense Walter Slocum said, quote, "There was a value in keeping the Afghan insurgency going, sucking the Soviets into a Vietnamese quagmire." In 1998, this U.S. trap was confirmed by Zbigniew Brzezinski. He was Carter's national security advisor between 1977 and 1981. He bragged, quote, "According to the official version of history, CIA assistance to the Mujahideen began during 1980, i.e. after the Soviet army had invaded Afghanistan on December 24, 1979. But the reality, kept secret until now, is very different. It was July 3, 1979, when President Carter signed the first directive on the clandestine assistance to opponents of the pro-Soviet regime in Kabul. On that day, I wrote to the President, Carter, saying this aid would bring about a military intervention by the Soviets. We did not push the Russians to intervene, but we knowingly increased the probability that they would." Unquote. In William Blum's excellent book on which summarizes CIA wars, it's called Killing Hope. Everyone should read that book. He notes, quote, "Prior to the Soviet invasion, the CIA was cultivating alliances with exiled Afghan guerrilla leaders by donating medicine and communications equipment. U.S. Foreign Service officers were meeting with Mujahideen leaders to determine their needs at least as early as April 79. In July, Carter signed a fining to aid the rebels covertly, which led to the U.S. providing cash, weapons, equipment, and supplies. In March 1979, Afghan's president visited Moscow. He was seeking Soviet military help. He wanted the Soviets to come in to help them because they were being attacked by American-backed terrorists. The Soviets would not commit ground troops. Premier Alexei Kosygin told him, quote, "The entry of our troops into Afghanistan would outrage the international community, triggering a string of extremely negative consequences. Our common enemies are just waiting for the moment when Soviet troops appear in Afghanistan. This will give them the excuse they need to send armed bands into the country." Unquote. The follow-up. After the Soviet invasion, the CIA spent billions arming the Afghan terrorists and their international friends. It was the CIA's biggest covert war ever. The propaganda offensive was an incredible psychological operation. The terrorists were seen as freedom fighters, and the Soviets were the evil invaders. Everyone fell right into line, and I remember lots of arguments with other activists back in the 1980s who unfortunately, because of the incredible media on this one, they bought the official version hook, line, and sinker. The real reasons for the war. In 1998, Brzezinski said, quote, "This secret operation was an excellent idea. It had the effect of luring the Russians into the Afghan trap. The day the Soviets officially crossed the border, I wrote to President Carter, we now have the opportunity to give the USSR its war in Vietnam. Moscow had to conduct an unbearable war for almost 10 years, which led to the demoralization and final breakup of the Soviet Empire. What is most important from the point of view of history of the world, the Taliban or the fall of the Soviet Empire? A few excited Muslims or the liberation of Central Europe and the end of the Cold War?" Okay, got two more. Hope I can get through two more examples, case studies, before a few concluding remarks. Okay, 1989, the invasion of Panama. The context. The Panama Canal has dominated Panama's history. There were 10 major U.S. wars and invasions or interventions between 1895 and 1989. In 1903, U.S. troops helped Panama separate from Colombia. Within days, a treaty gave the U.S. exclusive control of the canal. Panama's former military leader, Manuel Noriega, was recruited by the U.S. military intelligence at least as early as 1959. He attended the U.S. Army School of the Americas in 1967. It used to be located in Panama. Now it's in Georgia, and every year there are lots of thousands of people go there to protest. School of the Assassins, they call it. And anyway, Noriega began leading Panama's military intelligence the next year, at 68. Noriega met then CIA Director George Bush in 1976. In 1977, President Jimmy Carter signed a treaty to return the canal to Panamanian control. That was supposed to happen in 1999. But other Americans worked very hard to undermine the treaty. In the early 1980s, Noriega's drug smuggling helped fund the Contras in Nicaragua. He took control of Panama's National Guard in 83, and he helped rig elections in 84. Noriega eventually fell out of U.S. favor, and so they indicted him for drug crimes in 1988, although they had okayed these crimes since at least 75, when the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency supposedly first learned of it, of his involvement in the drug trade. The pretext incident occurred December 16, 1989. The U.S. media said that there had been an unprovoked attack, sound familiar, killing a U.S. soldier, and that the wife of a U.S. officer was reportedly arrested and beaten. However, Panama's version was different. They claimed that U.S. soldiers had fired on a Panamanian military headquarters, that the U.S. soldiers had wounded a Panamanian soldier, and that a one-year-old girl had also been wounded. A wounded Panamanian soldier confirmed this version to U.S. reporters. So what really happened? For months, the U.S. had been trying to provoke confrontations as a pretext for the invasion. There had been a similar incident 4 months earlier in August, and Panama's foreign minister asked for UN peacekeepers to be sent to Panama to prevent similar occurrences from happening. They knew that something was brewing. They probably saw a pretext coming. They actually asked for UN peacekeepers. They didn't get them. In December 89, it was revealed that four U.S. soldiers, known as the Hard Chargers, drove through a Panama City roadblock controlled by Panamanian soldiers. These hard chargers frequently hassled Panama's forces at roadblocks. They'd drive up to a roadblock, they'd swear, they'd make obscene gestures, they would hassle the Panamanian troops, and then they'd speed off in their vehicles. And on one occasion, Panamanian soldiers opened fire on four U.S. troops who refused to stop, and a U.S. soldier was killed. Although the Pentagon denied all this, the other three U.S. soldiers, the ones who survived, confirmed that they were not lost, as they had earlier claimed, and they said they deliberately went around to various checkpoints to hassle Panamanian troops and swear and make obscene gestures and then ride off. They were trying to provoke them, which they did. 4 days later, after the incident, Bush called for the U.S. invasion. He said the killing was the, quote, trigger to the decision, unquote. He also justified the invasion, saying the U.S. had to protect the canal. The follow-up was that the media dutifully reported that George Bush called the attack on U.S. soldiers an enormous outrage, and Bush said he would, quote, not stand up while American womanhood is threatened, unquote, and the pretext evolved, and the media began demonizing Noriega as well, and focused on the need to arrest him for drug smuggling. The media turned the Noriega issue into another justification for the invasion. So there's the pretext, and there's all these other reasons, and it's sort of this rolling pretext, and things are very fluid and change as they go along. But the initial pretext was that this poor American soldier had been shot by the horrible Panamanian soldiers. The real reasons for the invasion of Panama: it led to the abrogation of the treaty that had given the canal back to Panama. It forced Panama to dismantle its military. It increased U.S. military presence in Panama. It rectified Bush's wimpy foreign relations image. It provided a great show of U.S. military force in the months leading up to the Nicaraguan election. And so it provided a kind of threat to the Nicaraguans. You better vote the way we think you should vote, or you look what might happen to you. And it showed that the U.S. was willing to act unilaterally in the new order of the post-Cold War world. Okay, 1991, the Gulf War. Saddam Hussein had been an ally of the United States since at least the late 1950s, when he tried to assassinate Iraq's popular leader, Karim Qasem. In 1963, Hussein's Ba'athist Party finally overthrew the Qasem government thanks to a CIA-backed coup. Hussein then became the head of Iraq's secret police, and the CIA gave him death lists. They often do that. They'll have a coup, then they'll give these lists of names of, these are the people we want you to exterminate. That's what they did. They gave this list to Saddam. He was head of the secret police in the new Ba'athist government. And Hussein then led a campaign of torture and mass murder against Iraqi communists, unionists, and others on the CIA's list. Saddam was a ruthless, vicious killer, and that is precisely why the United States supported him. The United States supported the Iraq's military through the 1980s with the war during the war with Iran, in which a million people were killed. There's more on all this in there's my third and final, maybe not final, promotion for our magazine. There's a whole issue on the U.S. role in wars and regime changes in the Middle East since World War II. And it has two dozen examples. After the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, the rapid collapse of the Soviet Union, the U.S. began to set up Iraq as the next big enemy. During the summer of 1990, the Bush administration repeatedly assured Iraq that the U.S. would turn a blind eye if they were to invade Kuwait, which they were wont to do. So here's how the pretext was set up. In July 24th, State Department spokesperson Margaret Tutwiler told the media, quote, "We do not have any defense treaties with Kuwait, and there are no special defense or security commitments to Kuwait," unquote. The next day, Hussein was told the same thing by the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, April Glaspie. She gave him the green light to invade Kuwait. When he told her that Kuwait was carrying out acts of war against Iraq, Glaspie was very sympathetic, and she compared his situation with America's founding fathers, saying, quote, "We as a people have our own experience with colonialists," unquote. Glaspie also said, quote, "I have a direct instruction from the president to seek better relations with Iraq." And she also said, quote, "We have no opinion on the Arab-Arab conflicts, like your border disagreements with Kuwait," unquote. On July 31st, the U.S. Secretary of State John Kelly told the House Foreign Affairs Subcommittee, quote, "Historically, the U.S. has taken no position on border disputes in the area," unquote. The chairman asked Kelly, "If Iraq charged across the border into Kuwait, what would be our position with regard to the U.S. With the use of U.S. forces? Is it correct to say that we do not have a treaty commitment which would obligate us to engage U.S. forces there?" Kelly replied, "That is correct." So the pretext incident, clearly, August 2nd, a few days later, Iraqi forces did invade Kuwait. It was a pretext set up so that the U.S. could then wage war against Iraq. I mean, the Americans had supported Iraq during this whole war just a few years earlier against Iran. Why would Saddam be suspicious if the Americans were going to support him in another war, a smaller one? The follow-up. For this war, preparation of the public was privatized. The contract went to one of the world's biggest public relations firms, Hill & Knowlton. They used many lies to deceive the public. I'll focus on the main one, that formed the focal point for the whole campaign, I think. It was the main pretext. It was completely fabricated incident. Hill & Knowlton was hired by the Kuwaiti government front group called Citizens for a Free Kuwait. It formed on the very day that Iraq invaded Kuwait. On August 10th, a week later, Hill & Knowlton presented a 15-year-old called Naira to the House Human Rights Caucus. She was supposedly an ordinary Kuwaiti girl who had eyewitnessed horrible Iraqi atrocities. She had an emotional story, and it shocked Congress, and it shocked the whole world. She said, here's a quote from what she said, "I can't do the tearful 18-year-old girl look, but try to imagine it. I volunteered at the Al Aden Hospital. I saw the Iraqi soldiers come into the hospital with guns and go into the room where 15 babies were in incubators. They took the babies out of the incubators, took the incubators, and left the babies on the cold floor to die. Unquote. She didn't reveal at the time, or at any other time, but we found out that what her last name was. Turns out she's the daughter of Kuwait's ambassador to the United States. She was central to one of the most effective public relations campaigns in history. Hillen Knowlton's video news release featuring her story went to 700 U.S. TV stations and reached 35 million people. It was repeatedly cited in congressional debate and by the president in their efforts to launch the war. Amnesty International fell for the lie and said that 312 babies had been murdered. The real reasons. Okay, there's three real reasons for the war. Oil, oil, and oil. No, actually, there's always many goals for wars, and besides making billions of dollars selling oil to transport hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops to Iraq and thousands of planes and tanks, the U.S. military-industrial complex made billions of dollars selling weapon systems. They got to test out their nifty new killing machines, their new toys. The war also created a new raison d'etre for the U.S. military. I think that's maybe one of the most important purposes for that war. With the disappearance of the Soviet Union, and the boogie monster of communism that was the prime enemy of the United States and the so-called free world that underlay all justifications for military spending and wars during the whole Cold War period, the U.S. needed a new enemy. So Hussein continued to fill that role as the new enemy for another 10 years. And the Islamic world is also... Hussein is the figurehead within the context of the Islamic world at being the enemy. So it's a perfect setup for the wars that have come since. In examining the history of how wars are started, certain patterns emerge. The use of war pretext can easily be seen. It's a specific type of modus operandi. It's a criminal method of operations, and it emerges, and it's remarkably consistent over the centuries. If all of these events that I've just mentioned had occurred in one lifetime, I would probably think, oh, there's a very wicked mass murderer out there, and he's running around doing all these horrible things. It seems almost as if it's one person doing it. But, of course, it can't be one person because it's been done over 150 years, or if you look back even farther, over thousands of years. So unless we start believing in vampires and the undead, it's not one person. It's a repeated pattern of war pretext, and it's not a coincidence. It reflects the fact that this is an institutionalized form of behavior that is taught. People are trained to do these things. It's part of an ongoing tradition, a culture. It's a pattern of thought and action that is passed down from one generation to the next. It's vitally important for us to expose these war pretext incidents and to reveal the real, largely economic and geostrategic purposes for the wars. Pretexts are needed because the real economic reasons for war are unacceptable to the general public. If people were asked to support wars so that wealthy elites could go and plunder faraway human resources and natural resources, people would likely refuse to cooperate. War planners know this, and over the millennia they've developed a special martial art, the creation of pretext stratagems, including the specific type that I've been talking about, war pretext incidents. These are elaborate webs of deceit, and they're woven to create the appearance that wars are fought for just, moral, and humanitarian reasons. By unraveling this intricate web of pretenses, it's woven to deceive the public, we can begin to reveal how corporations are the main benefactors of war. By throwing light on repeated historical patterns of deception, we can also promote a healthy skepticism about government and corporate media yarns that are being constantly spun to justify current wars and to promote the wars of the future. I think by doing what we're doing, which is trying to reveal history, we're trying to show how, from using examples from the past, if people are become aware of these things, it's kind of like inoculating them against when similar things happen again in the future, we can try to give booster shots of skepticism to people by immunizing them using these examples from history. I think if people know about this history, then when they see something in the newspaper, they'll go, wait a minute, this sounds a bit fishy. very quickly, I don't know how many people know about this, but this is something that I think everybody should know about. I think if people knew this, that it would blow things apart. That is that the Bush family itself has all these connections, not just with bin Laden, but with financing Hitler before World War II. And the Bush family made millions of dollars from slave labor at Auschwitz. And then after the war, they were laundering money for Hitler's biggest banker donor, supporter, Fritz Thyssen. I mean, the Bush family, his grandfather and his great-grandfather, were actually very deeply tied into financing the Nazis, helping them during the war, and then even after the war, laundering their money. This is where the Bush family fortune comes from. This is how they got launched into the oil business. This is how they got launched into politics. It's through Nazi slave labor money from Auschwitz. It's mind-blowing. It's not just sort of fabricated conspiracy theory nonsense. It's real history. This is, I mean, we have a serious problem on our hands here.
Thank you again, Richard, for this. There's nothing more heartbreaking for an American who would like to believe in motherhood and apple pie, Superman and Santa Claus, to hear that we have this institutionalized behavior. I mean, you also mentioned in your pamphlet also about 1983 invasion of Grenada with Reagan, and 99 Clinton and Kosovo. It just goes on and on, one administration after another. Mm-hmm. The question is, how do you get these? What is the institution, as you understand it, that is able to create this behavior and agreement with no matter who it is who runs for public office?
I don't think it's one particular institution. I think it's probably sort of groups of people from different institutions, like from the CIA, from the military, also corporate leaders. I mean, we saw with the case with the fascist plot against Roosevelt in the 30s, the people that were behind it weren't the military, really. I mean, there were military people in it, but the main pushers of this fascist coup plot in the United States were corporate leaders. They were the heads of the biggest corporations and the wealthiest bankers. It's probably a grouping of people from those intelligence, military, and corporate worlds that, I mean, anybody who thinks that these guys don't get together and try to organize things to make the world better for them, they're very naive. I mean, we get together, we're here, we're conspiring to try to make the world a better place the way we imagine it. They do the same thing. And the thing is, they have a lot of money. They have billions of dollars. They have hundreds of thousands or millions of troops that they can call into action. We don't. I mean, we can order. We can organize a conference. We can organize a street theater. But we can't organize to send a million people somewhere. So they have an incredible amount of power. And they, like, there's that quote from the anthropologist Margaret Mead, who says, "Never doubt that a small group of dedicated, resourceful people can change the world. That nothing else ever has." Well, it's the same thing with these fascists. It's a small group of people. Get together, they can change the world, except they can do it a lot more easily than we can because they have billions of dollars.
Hi, my name is David Johnson, and I'm from Denver, Colorado. We had, at my school, I go to Princeton University, in this past February, Colin Powell, we had the pleasure of his presence on our campus, and He, aside from justifying continued involvement in escalation in Iraq, when he was fielding questions from the audience, one of the questions was with regard to communism and kind of our adventures in combating communism over the past 50 years. And Colin Powell's response, the question regarded supporting fascist dictators and counter-revolutionary, activities of the. I don't think the CIA was explicitly mentioned, but what Colin's response was is, yes, we've had some interesting bedfellows, and very interesting bedfellows, he said. And I think my question to you is, from what you've said today, it's pretty easy to destroy this idea that that it's merely a crusade against communism, but that the backdrop is that's used as a backdrop, but the reality is that it's for greed and for corporatization and for profit making and how my question to you is, how do you best tell someone who these leaders that like to absolve themselves of the past and say, I don't want to talk about the past, I don't want to talk about communism, you know, I don't want to talk about our interesting bedfellows because that's over, we should talk about right now, when it seems that that's been repeated over and over again. Every 3 or 4 years, they say that again. They're constantly saying, let's not talk about the past. But a lot of the stories that you say that is released to the press in the present is just based on fantasy. So how do you best address someone that wants to say, well, let's talk about the present, when really all the facts, we're not dealing with politicians who have full disclosure? How can you best convince someone that that's the case, that that the reality of the present is really difficult to see with, you know, with the lucidity of history, you know, hindsight?
You have to look at the past. I mean, you can't let them get away with saying, oh, I don't want to talk about the past. I mean, what else is there to talk about? We can't talk about the future because it hasn't happened yet. And the present, well, it's moving along so fast that we can't really talk about the present either. So the only thing we can talk about is the past. These people that, some people you can't argue with anyway. I mean, someone like Colin Powell, I wouldn't even really bother trying to argue with him. You're never going to convince him of anything. Some people are so deeply set in their mindset that you cannot get at them. You can't just, so don't even bother trying. It's the general population. It's the masses of people that you really want to get your message to. You want to convince the general public. I think we have to address our knowledge and give our information to sort of public opinion leaders, activists, radicalize people that are already very suspicious or a little bit suspicious of what's going on, and you want to get those people. You want to get your information to those people. The Colin Powells of the world, don't even waste your breath trying to convince them of anything, because they're way gone past convincing.
I'm going into your presentation and the way it was structured with motive for the pretext. And I've been thinking about this a long time, and I wonder about three cases that I would evoke to for your comment. One of them is Panama, with Noriega being an ally in covert, nice cozy relationship over the decades. Same thing with Saddam in Iraq. I bring in Serbia also to this. Milovan being the tried as a war criminal and so on, and getting this, all three of them getting that same treatment. And I'm trying to find a common denominator. And what I'm suggesting to you, and I'd ask you for your reaction to this, didn't they all have in common the complexity, even though they were all two of the three anyhow were allies of the U.S. that they had with their national following, the Ba'ath Party, whatever party Noriega had in Panama, and Serbia, they were bucking the globalist privatization and oil. They had their own oil, nationalized oil, something of that nature. I'm looking for an economic reason why they would be allies one day and wake up the next day as demonized. That's one thing. And the next thing I wanted to ask about is, wasn't the Joint Chiefs of Staff recommendation to the then president, I'm not sure who it was, I think it was JFK in 1962, to attack Cuba with right. pretext, that's right. right in there. Wasn't that JFK?
Yeah.
Okay.
On the first point, thing about how friends can become enemies, over the decades people change, and American assets out in the field, leading countries far away, they need to stay in power, and so in order to stay in power they need to do things which even the Americans don't want them to do, and so they may get a little unruly and do things that force the Americans to reject them as allies and turn them into enemies. Noriega was a good, strong ally for many decades, but eventually he started cozying up a little bit with Cuba, I think, and he refused to be a staging point for attacks on Nicaragua, I think, was one of the things he refused to do for the Americans. So he just wasn't playing his part anymore, so they had to get rid of him. Gaddafi, too, is another one. He was started off with some American help, yeah. And on the other point about... I was going to read out a whole bunch of stuff from that 1962 Joint Chiefs of Staff document on Northwoods, but I had to take it out to shorten my talk. But yeah, it's incredible. I really encourage people, if they don't know anything about that, to find out more about this, the plans to create pretext for war with Cuba. It's incredible. Like, it's just like a brainstorming session from... You've got a group of sociopaths and psychopaths and mass murderers sitting around in a room together, and they're coming up with plans on how to provoke war. It's incredible. It's like a whole series of things. Like they say, yeah, it's very clear. It's like, okay, here we're going to come up with 100 ways of faking Cuba attacking us. So remember the Maine type incident. We could sink one of our own ships. They talk about taking MiG fighters, painting them up in Cuban with Cuban insignia, pretending to shoot down American passenger planes. It's an incredible document. If people have on the internet, they can just type in Operation Northwoods, or it's in our magazine.
Yes, I teach studies in propaganda, and I'm a member of CUMR, the Committee on Monetary and Economic Reform. I would like to suggest two very important books as far as funding all these wars. One, they're both by Anthony Sutton. One is called Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler. The other book is called Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution. As far as all these secret societies, if you've got the time from 1 till 5 a.m., you can tune into Art Bell. He's a pretty good distraction. And I would have one question at the end. I think something should be explained about how these huge banks fund the wars, how their money is created out of thin air so that they can have a million people moved if they want, because all they have to do is put numbers in a computer and they've got all the billions they need. So that's very important here. Thank you.
Also, Gary Bell on 11 o'clock on Mocha Radio, AM 640.
Okay, don't get me wrong. It's not that I don't believe that these powerful industrialists and bankers get together and have meetings and secret meetings. I don't doubt that for a minute. I know that's true. I just haven't looked into Bilderbergs and Freemasons very much, so I can't comment on that. But I don't think, and if we want to talk about IBM and Henry Ford, we don't need to get into Freemasons and that sort of thing in order to talk about how Henry Ford, you know, was writing the International Jew, and how Hitler had a copy of it on his desk, and they each had a picture of them, the other one on behind them on the wall in their office, and that kind of thing. You don't need to talk about Freemasons in order to expose how these big capitalist multi-billionaires are getting together and coordinating things as best they can. They can't control the world, but they can try, and they do have a lot of power.
You've been listening to Richard Sanders on the history of the war pretext stratagem. He spoke at the International Citizens Inquiry into the Unanswered Questions of 9/11, held last May in Toronto. More hearings were held last week in New York City, and we plan to obtain that material for you as well. For more information on how to get involved in the 9/11 truth movement, visit 911truth.org, 911truth.org. And you can contact this program through our website, unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.